Well, thank you again, everybody, for coming. We're going to do something a little different today. There's all these different ways that we talked about for evidence for God. But one of the big ones I wanted to talk about was your personal story. And this one is not necessarily directed for the skeptic or anything like that. It's more just to encourage you yourselves, you know, so you don't forget your story. But in order to do that, I feel like I have to touch on one other thing real quick before we get into that. I made a comment a couple weeks ago about a study that was done about near-death experiences, and I kind of want to talk on that a little bit, though I hope that someday we can talk a little more about it. Today's just going to be quick. There's a book that was written by a guy. His name is Bruce Grayson. He's a doctor. And he's been studying near-death experiences for 50 years. And he is the leader in the field. There's many other people that do this too. But he's written books about this, and he's done so many studies. He tells a story in this book. It's just called After. Very simple. He tells a story that got him started, that got him interested. And he had just become an intern at an emergency room. And a lady brought in another lady. They were roommates at college. And they were 19. They didn't know each other well. They had only been roommates for a couple weeks. And the one lady tried to overdose. She tried to kill herself. She overdosed on, I think it was anxiety medicine and stuff. But so the other lady brought her in, and so this Dr. Grayson was down in the lunchroom. He was eating dinner, and he was eating spaghetti, and all of a sudden his pager went off, and it scared him. And so he dropped his fork, and it splashed up onto his shirt, and he tried to wipe it off real quick, and he got up, and he put on his white lab coat and buttoned it up because he didn't want anybody to see his stain up in the actual ER. So he went up there, he walked in the room, and this lady was unconscious. She was non-responsive, and he tried for a long time to wake her up, and she wouldn't wake up. And so he finally just decided he was going to go down the hall and talk to the other lady in the waiting room, the one that brought her in. And he specifically says that he'd walk out the hallway, and it was 50 meters down, around the corner was a waiting room. And so he went down there. And this was back in the 70s, and there was no air conditioning in the hospital. So he sat down to talk to this lady. And he points out exactly what he did. He grabbed a fan because it was hot, and he brought the fan over and set it down right next to them to cool him off. And then he got hot, so he unbuttoned his lab coat. And he was talking to the lady. I'm not going to get into the details just because that's going to take forever, and I know you guys are going to read this. They had their conversation. He got up to shake her hand, you know, tell her that they'd get a hold of her in the morning, sent her off, if there was any progress made. And so as soon as he stood up and went to shake her hand, he realized that he could see his stain on his shirt, on his tie. So he buttoned his coat back up because he didn't want any professionals to see stain on his clothes. So he went back. I believe he again tried waking her up again in the room, and she was still non-responsive. And so they told him, because it was time for him to be off, that he had to come back right away in the morning to send her off to the psychiatric people, however that process goes. So he come back in the morning, and she had just been starting to wake up, so she was out all night. She was monitored all night. She was just starting to wake up. And so he comes in and he tries talking to her, and he sees that she opens up one eye and looks at him. And so he takes advantage of it and he introduces himself. And he says, "Hey, I'm Dr. Grayson." And she mutters, she's like, "Yeah, I know who you are. I remember you from last night." And he was kind of thrown back. And so he asked her, he says, but I was trying to wake you up last night and you weren't responsive. You wouldn't say anything. I couldn't get anything out of you. And she said, no, I'm not talking about that. I saw you in the waiting room talking to my roommate. And he, once again, he didn't believe it. So he sat there and stared at her, and she said, yeah, you're the guy with the striped tie with the spaghetti stain on your shirt. And she said, yeah, because you walked over and you grabbed the fan and put it next to you guys because you were hot. And then she goes on to repeat verbatim, word for word, the entire conversation that he had had with her roommate. And there were no phones in the hospital, and he goes in his book all the skeptic ways that you could think of to try to debunk how she knew. He looked through every avenue that he could. There's no way that she could, that the lady that saw the conversation could have, there's just no way that she could have known. She couldn't have heard. Nobody could have talked to her. She was out all night until he got back that morning. So she was unconscious. This is a common theme when it comes to near-death experiences, or even these out-of-body experiences, where the people say that they leave their body. And there's so many studies, it's undeniable. There's so many studies of all these experiences these days. So many people weren't speaking out for a long time because they were scared, because they would just get sent straight to the psychiatric ward if they come to and were talking about this stuff. And now it's not that big of a deal anymore, because they're so common and people are actually opening up and talking about them. Therefore, now they can actually study them. But the thing, the skeptics would say that it's all these things are just brain functions. Your neurons firing as you're dying. Your brain's kind of just doing one last hurrah. But they've debunked that doing all these studies, seeing that brain activity is pretty much diminished or gone when these things happen. So there's no way that it could be your brain doing these. And they'll say oftentimes that it's a lack of oxygen. The skeptics will say that it's a lack of oxygen to your brain because you're dying. But they do the studies on people who are into hallucinogens, you know, mushrooms and stuff like that, and they still have these same spiritual experiences where their brain activity, that's what these things do, is they cause your brain to be not inactive, but less active when they have these experiences. But they have full levels of oxygen in their brain at the same time, so it debunks that accusation from them as well. There's a lot of common themes that are interesting. If you study these experiences, people will, they'll always bring up a bright, radiant light kind of a thing that they see. A lot of times a God figure. They'll see relatives, that kind of thing. That's one other thing that the skeptics can't debunk. They can't say anything to the person that is born blind, that has one of these near-death experiences, and they come to and they're explaining stuff that they saw. People who they've never seen in their life, but they see in their experience. It's not something that was already in your brain because you've never seen it, but now you see it. They can't debunk when a child that is prelingual, before he's able to talk, has one of these near-death experiences and talks about it a decade later. And before they could even talk, they were having conversations in their near-death experience that just so happened to be totally accurate. Obviously, it's just a coincidence. They see people communicated with relatives from their past, or from their family's past, because the family knows exactly who they're talking about. The skeptics can't debunk these things. He tells a story in here about a child that he was having surgery. The dad brought him in, And he had one of these experiences. And he came to, and he was telling his dad that he was just talking to his sister, his 19-year-old sister that just went off to college. And the sister told him to tell dad that, don't worry, you know, everything's okay, I'm fine where I'm at, tell him not to worry. And the dad got all upset, and he actually wanted the doctors to give him more anesthetics to make him stop talking because it upset him. Well, he got upset, he went back to the house, and it turned out that the university had been trying to get a hold of him for the past day and a half and couldn't. And that sister, or that kid's sister, had died the day before in a car accident, a day and a half earlier, and there's no way that this kid could have known. There's just no way. The skeptics, they can't just blame it on the brain when something like that happens. And it's so common. The main gist of this book, pretty much, is to not necessarily prove, but to put out there the idea that the mind is different than the brain. I believe everybody in here agrees with that, believes that. A lot of people don't. They think that the brain is a product, or the mind is a product of just memories in the brain. But this guy is of the argument from 50 years of studies that the brain is the receiver, is the way he words it. The mind would be the giver of the information. So whether you, I don't know. He gives examples from people that have had these, and they always have a common theme explaining how different it was, how real it was. It was realer than reality when they experienced this thing. They come back oftentimes not being able to explain to the full extent of what they experienced. But they'll say things like, they feel like their whole life they've been living in a warehouse, in a giant warehouse, and all they have is this little tiny flashlight. And when they have the experience, it's like somebody turns on the lights, they can see everything. They can understand everything. And then they get there. Somehow they come back into their body, it's like they shut the lights back off and you're stuck with this. And they oftentimes get upset. And they don't even want to be here because now they can't even explain what they saw. That's so common of a theme in these near-death experiences. I hope that someday we can talk more about it, but we got to move on. I wanted to explain that quick because for a long time I felt crazy, I guess. So I grew up Catholic. I always desired God, but I never knew you could have a relationship with him. That was just a totally foreign concept, and when you heard that, that was just something that those crazy Protestants said, and it made no sense. But my parents are very devoted. On Sunday mornings, anyways, for an hour out of their week. They're very Catholic. I grew up in a kind of a secluded home. We were pretty sheltered as kids. And believe it or not, I was a very quiet kid. My whole life I struggled with this. I didn't know it for a long time, but struggled with this thing, social anxiety. And I personally believe it was more than that, but I was told by a counselor that this is what it was. I fit all the descriptions. I was never medically diagnosed or however you do that process. But he told me this is what it is. When I was probably in first grade, I remember we finally got to go to this park by the school because our little playground at school was tiny. So we finally got to walk 3 blocks to the park And on the way there, everybody was talking about this amazing slide at the park. Everybody was excited for the slide. So we get up, I was the last person. We had first and second grade, and I was the last person in first grade to go up the steps to the landing. And everybody goes down the slide, and the guy behind me, as soon as I get up there, the first second grader in line grabs me by the shoulders, and he asks if he can cut in front of me. And I just looked at him, did like this, shrugged my shoulders. Because with this social anxiety thing, I don't know how to explain it, but you always would want to talk, but you couldn't. I don't know how to explain it other than that. But I couldn't say nothing to the kid, so I just kind of shrugged my shoulders, and he was like, yeah, and he pushed me to the side. And he went down the slide, and the next kid behind him did the same thing, and everybody behind him did the same thing as the guy in front, and they all asked if they could cut in front of me, and I just stood there and let them all go. Second grade, first grade come back around. Everybody went through probably three times. I stood up there on the landing because I couldn't say a word. I did get to go down, but I was the last kid down because it was time to go. I'm just trying to give you an example. In fifth grade, maybe it was fourth or fifth, we had music class. I got a twin sister. She was in my class with me. And they had everybody come up, and everybody had to sing their solos in front of the keyboard while the instructor played the keyboard, because you had to make sure that you knew your five pitches or whatever it is. And I got up there. All the kids in the classroom, we just do it in front of everybody. And I stood there, and nothing came out, obviously, in front of everybody. And she was getting frustrated with me, the teacher, you could tell, and she was getting mad and saying things. And finally, I just stood there, and I just cried in front of everybody. So not only could I not say anything, I just now made a fool of myself in front of everybody. Fast forward to senior year. We did in the newspaper, the school newspaper, every year they always did a thing for the senior class that was going to graduate. They voted on different categories. I remember the guy that got the second highest percent of votes, I voted for him. He was the most athletic senior in the school. It was the entire school would vote for the senior class because they were the ones that were leaving. So there was probably 800 kids in the school. There was about 200 per class, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade. So he got 34% of the school voted him the most athletic kid in the school, or the most athletic senior. The third highest percent was a girl that got the most artistic, and she got 16% of the school voted her the most artistic senior. And I won a category that had never won before. They actually had a category, the quietest person. I got 52% of the school. I got 400 people. I didn't even know 400 people in the school. Guarantee it. Voted me the quietest kid in the senior class. So the last probably 2 months of my senior year, I got introduced to this thing called alcohol. Anybody heard of it? This thing had this amazing ability, I don't know how, to take whatever it was stopping me from being able to speak, whatever it was stopping me from being able to be me, it would take that away. I would never say that I was addicted to alcohol, but I would definitely say I was addicted to that feeling, to not having that hindrance. It literally turned me into a new person. And I'm sure there's reasons for that, I don't know. All I knew was that it worked. So for the next 3 years, the end of my senior year, and until right before I turned 21, that was my life. It was the only thing that worked. The only thing that made me so that I could, like I said, be me. I wasn't trapped in my own mind. I felt like I was in prison. So often people think that the quiet person is quiet because they want to be. That's not the case. Maybe some, but I got a feeling that a vast majority, that's not the case. After high school, everybody that I knew, siblings, all my friends, they all left. They all went places because they had things to do in their life. They had plans, they had goals, they had all that. I didn't have anything because I already found what I needed. So I was a custodian for years. I still have that problem today. I like to work alone. There's a reason for that. As a custodian at a high school, so I'd work when school got out. I'd go in at 3. I'd get off at 11:30 or midnight. And so in high school, I never had a problem being active. Like I couldn't do team sports because you had to be with people. I was in wrestling, I was in powerlifting. I could do these things that you could do by yourself. I couldn't be on a team sport. And so after a couple years after high school, they started these, they called them cage fights where I grew up. And so I got this extreme desire. I thought it would be awesome. It was something I could do. A goal I could have, and I wouldn't have to talk to anybody, wouldn't have to worry about that. It would be great. So I had this out of nowhere desire to start training for MMA. But in order to do that, I had to switch jobs in order to make the class time work, because it was at 6:30 at night to 8:30 at night. So I applied for a job at a college. And I got it because nobody else applied. I didn't even interview because nobody wanted to work the graveyard shift. I'd go in at 10 o'clock at night. I'd get off at 6:30 in the morning. And nobody wanted that. I remember talking to a few years after this, I was talking to a guy that hired me into a different school, and he told me, I love honest people, he told me the only reason he hired me is because he knew me, because he had seen me, my work ethic, before. He said if we were going off of interviews, he said you would have been the first one off the list. You were the worst interviewer I've ever interviewed. I can see that. But I got this job because nobody else wanted it. I would get home at 6:30 in the morning. I would sit down every day like a ritual, and I'd watch this TV show, Becker. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. It was, that time, it was probably my favorite show. It was kind of a comedy show, but definitely not good for the soul or anything like that. But I remember at one of these fights that I went to, I saw that the guy that had lost in the fight. He comes down and even he got swarmed by people. He got a huge crowd around him. The guy that lost, the guy that won, he was bigger, and I don't know why I never noticed it, but all of a sudden I noticed that, and that's my first thought is, oh, great, there's no way this can happen. So that ruined that dream for me. I was so fed up with life, and I had suicidal thoughts for a long time, but it was never like made up my mind kind of a thing. But now, after that happens, and then I find out that the girl that I had feelings for, that I had dated back in high school, now just got pregnant with another man. That didn't help anything. So I was super, super depressed. I was working as a custodian at a school where a lot of the kids that were going to school were older than me. It was embarrassing. But it didn't matter, I guess, because I still had my alcohol in the morning when I get home at 6:30. It was that way for a good couple of years. One day I was so fed up with life, I actually couldn't even stand the show Becker, my favorite show. I couldn't stand it this morning. It was March 7th, 2008. It was a Friday. I had decided that, well, actually, March 7th, I had decided was going to be the day that I was actually officially going to do. I was going to follow through with it. This was going to be my last day. I had it all planned out. I was going to go after work at 10:30 at night. I was going to go drive down to this field I drove by all the time. The gate was always open, and you drive in there, and it was right over top of a hill. There was no tracks going in, so it didn't look like anybody would ever go there. You look off in the distance, there's no houses in the background. I figured it'd be perfect for nobody to ever find me for a long time. If it would have played out that way, I don't know. But I had decided that March 7th was the day that I was going to do it. I was just going to be done because I couldn't handle anything. I get home from work Friday morning at 6:30. It's like I always do. I turned on my TV first. I'd walk in, I'd turn on my TV, I'd go to the fridge, I'd grab my beer, I'd go sit on the couch. And I couldn't explain it then, but I can now. I know that it was God just making me totally dissatisfied with this TV show. It was all of a sudden, it was just awful. It was vulgar. It was sick. It was twisted. There's no reason anybody should be watching this show. So I started flipping channels, and I got some soap opera where some woman had just found out that her sister had been sleeping with her husband or something stupid, and then I flipped it again, and it was a war show, and people were just getting killed, shot. It was the weirdest thing. I've never seen this much violence, just nasty stuff on TV. I had basic cable, so I had, I think, 24 channels or something like that at the apartment. I went, my last resort, I just wanted one last peaceful day of watching TV. I went to the Weather Channel because I figured they'd be safe. I got to the Weather Channel and it was the 10 deadliest natural disasters of the 20th century. They immediately started talking about how many thousands of people had died in this particular storm. I got so fed up with it, I took my TV. They were real TVs back then. They're just as deep as they are wide. I slid it off from the wall and I unplugged my cable. And I hooked up my rabbit ears. Remember those? I hooked that up hoping that there would be something that just at least wasn't so bad. So I plugged in my rabbit ears. I slammed it up against the wall. I sat down. I was flipping through the channels. Now I only get, I think it was 11 channels. But my TV was programmed for the 20-something. So I flipped through all the channels and I just saw all the repeat, all the same stuff that I'd seen already. So I start flipping through the fuzzy channels. Just static and fuzz on the TV. And finally, I was flipping slow motion. I would sit there and watch every channel, every fuzz channel, just hoping that something, I would flip it, I would take a drink, I'd stare at it, I'd flip to the next one, I'd do the same thing. Finally, I got to one of them, and I heard a voice, a guy talking. He's just a weird voice. If you've ever heard his voice, you can recognize it anytime. It's just different. I saw on the fuzz on the TV, I could see the outline of a man's head and his shoulders, and that's actually what his TV show is. It's just a camera sitting on him while he's talking. His name was Andrew Womack. I couldn't see him. I couldn't make out his face. I could just see that there was an outline and somebody was talking to me. And I happened to get there right at the end of his TV show that day. And he was telling me that God actually loved me. See, I had come to a point 2 weeks before this where I didn't believe in God at all. I actually had a friend come back over Christmas break, so a couple months before, from college, and he was telling me about this new amazing upcoming thing that was going to be so great. It's called YouTube. And we didn't have smartphones back then or nothing. All you have is a flip phone. So it's like, I don't know how you do YouTube. So he told me I had to get a computer. So I had to, he brought me to Best Buy and pretty much picked it out and all that and showed me what I had to do, had to get. Came back to the apartment with me, hooked it up. Got YouTube all set up. And I got into something on YouTube, an old radio show that they had recorded and put on there. I'm not going to get into who it was or anything, because I don't want him having any credit. But I was embarrassed about this for a long time, even after I was saved. But he totally convinced me that there was no God. He had me convinced, and I feel silly saying it, but it's amazing how many people actually believe it. We weren't created by God. God is totally made up. We were created by these super intelligent beings. There are lots of people that believe this. And I swallowed this thing, hook, line, and sinker. He never actually said it, but you can tell just by listening that it seemed like it was his life goal to prove that God didn't exist and that you were created by these aliens. Or he didn't say that. He didn't say that word. But that's the picture that you got. He said the Bible was sent down by them to us to keep man, just to walk this moral line so that we didn't go crazy, so we didn't kill each other and murder, rape, all that stuff, so that we would at least be somewhat moral creatures. But his big thing was that there was absolutely no God, and he proved it. Proved it to me, convinced me. And so on top of everything that was going on in my life, realizing that there was no God, that was the icing on the cake. There's no reason to live. So I had this plan that Friday, I was going to go into that field. I was going to go park my car over the hill. I was going to stand on the roof of my car. and I was going to scream at whatever the hell it was that made me. I was going to give it 3 seconds to come down. I was going to count to three. And if it didn't come down, if it didn't beam me up, if it didn't put something in front of me, if it didn't do something, I was going to get in the passenger side of my car. And I was going to make sure that nobody would ever be able to tell that I ever had a frontal lobe with my .30-06. This guy pops up on my TV that morning, Friday morning, after I got off work, telling me that this God that I didn't believe in loved me. Almost 21 years of being Catholic, I never once heard that. I didn't even know that was a concept. God was just somebody that you obeyed. You had to do certain things and not do certain things, and that was it. But what got me is Andrew Womack wasn't okay with just telling me that. He wanted to prove it to me. He wanted to prove that God loved me. He said that Jesus always used miracles to verify what he was saying was true. Again, I've never heard this, anything like it. And he dared to say that we, to say we believe in him, ought to verify what we say about him today. He wanted to prove to me, using miracles, using healing, that God did love me, that he actually loved people. Only thing is, this was the end of the TV show. He said on Monday morning, he was gonna start a new series where he was gonna do just that. He was gonna prove it. So I don't remember anything about that weekend. I don't remember anything about the rest of that day. I actually forgot about my plans for that night until a few weeks later, when all of a sudden I remembered one day what I was going to do. I couldn't believe it. I don't remember anything at all except for the thought in my head. I could not stop thinking about this guy wants to prove that a God I don't believe in loves me. So I never got up on Monday mornings. I didn't have to. I didn't work until 10 o'clock at night. There's no reason to be up. But I remember I got up Monday morning because I had a reason to. Completely forgot what I was going to do Friday. The whole weekend is blank other than waking up Monday morning for this TV show. I couldn't find him because I still had my rabbit ears plugged in. Couldn't find him anywhere. So I unplugged that and I replugged my cable back in and I found a voice. And I found a face. And so I watched it. And so Monday was pretty much just an introduction to his series and the concept, the idea of God heals today, just like, because this was what the topic was healing. He said that Jesus used miracles like a cowbell to draw people to him so that he could speak to him. A lot of cool little sayings that he would say. And he told me that Tuesday, the next day, he was going to start an actual story, a healing story. The lady that had received healing. And so he started that on Tuesday. Her name was Nikki. And he finished on Wednesday. It was a 2-day thing. I'm not going to get into the story, but it was, at that time, it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. Wednesday morning, March 12th, after the TV show was over. Again, I couldn't have explained it then. I didn't know what was happening. I can explain it now because it was God. But I remember sitting on my couch. I shut the TV off. And I just, like, God was actually real. This God that I had not just renounced, what I had said not so good things about the idea of God, because I felt I'd been lied to my whole life, because I no longer believed that he was real. I started apologizing for all this stuff that I said. I started apologizing for everything that I've done in my life. I was sitting on my couch and I just fell to my knees and I started crying on the floor in my one-bedroom apartment. This is besides that time in music class. It's the only time I've ever cried. I'm kidding. I was sitting there on my knees, and then all of a sudden, I couldn't explain it then, and I couldn't explain it for a long time until I learned. All of a sudden, like, my TV's right here, my doorway is right there. All of a sudden, there's a man in my doorway. And somehow I just knew that it was this Jesus that I did not believe in. I was just beginning to again. And I had come up out of my body. He stood there like this. And I knew what he wanted. I'd come up out of my body, I gave him a hug, because that's what he wanted. And I come back into my body, and I lift my head up, and he's gone. I could never explain that, and I always felt silly for even thinking that that actually happened. But that was the realest thing I've ever experienced in my life. I've never experienced anything so real. That's exactly what goes on in these stories, these people that talk about. I don't know if that's why I'm so intrigued with these near-death experiences, these out-of-body experiences. They say the same exact thing. It was the realest thing. It was realer than this. It was realer than this. It was the realest thing I've ever experienced. It was only seconds. I got saved that morning, having no concept of being saved. Never heard of it. I never went to an altar. I never prayed a prayer. I never bowed my head and closed my eyes and repeated after anybody. I got up and I hugged Jesus. And my life since then has never been the same. That ex, huh? I'm confessing him now. I still confess him. I believe in my heart, absolutely. But I never did it in a sense of a, how I, you know what I'm trying to say. Yeah, I've never done that. But after that actual, I still obviously struggle with being around people. It's definitely not my place I prefer to be. But the actual crippling part of it was gone. It's no longer a crippling, holding me back thing. I feel I'm still going to struggle with it for a long time, but it is what it is. But it's not stopping me from anything anymore. And these skeptics that will say something, that an experience like that is just the mind playing tricks on you or whatever, I can't swallow that because of my personal story, how it actually changed me when nothing else could. Like, alcohol was just a temporary, I mean, the next day it was gone. This was not that. This guy uses an example in this book regarding the skeptic that tells people that what they experienced was not real. He says it's like going up to somebody that just got hit by a truck and trying to tell them that they didn't get hit by a truck. You know, it was just your mind. It was something. They try explaining it away. And he says, you get hit by a truck, you know you got hit by a truck. It doesn't matter what anybody says. It's the same concept. Jesus is real. There's nothing that can take your personal story from you. Everybody has a different story. Totally different. Everybody does. Well, it doesn't mean that one is any better, one is any less or worse than the other. Everybody has a story. I don't know if anybody in here has a story that they want to share. I know we talked. I don't know if you're still interested or not. But if anybody wants to share something that God has done in their life or their salvation process, I'd be more than willing to let anybody share. Today's not just necessarily my story. Everybody has a story. Want to?
Well, I was growing up, I was kind of like you. My college counselor, I remember sitting at a desk when I went to the University of Minnesota, and so she was, my college counselor was determining what classes I should take, what's the best route for me. And she left for a while to go to the bathroom or take care of some duty. So I was alone at her desk for a while, and I looked at her notes. And her notes said, "Michael is reticent, uncommunicative." I thought, "Oh yeah," because I didn't really know, other than wanting to be a rock star. That was about it for my life at that time, because I could play music. And so I was in college because my parents basically paid for it. They wanted to give me college, so I took it. But I was deep into alcoholism. Anyway, I was born again in 1991. I was almost 38 years old. And after being a band musician for a couple of decades, an alcoholic, which is easy to do in the music business, I was on my way home from a gig. So this is my testimony. I was on my way home from a gig at a bowling alley in Maplewood, and the band I was with, Classics Band, 50s, 60s band, we just tore down our equipment after three nights, like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I think. And there weren't many people at the gig that night. There was maybe a table full for a while, and then nobody for a while, and then a couple other people. So kind of a throwaway gig, sort of. And so we were sitting at the bar on the breaks having beers and shots every break. So by the end of the night, we were all, except for maybe one of the band members didn't drink, but the rest of us, we were pretty sloshed by the end of the night. And it was an open keg on the dance floor on one of the tables as we were loading out our PA equipment, which me and the guitar player and whoever else partook of, you know. So I was stone drunk by the time I got in my car to drive home. And I didn't want to sleep in the parking lot. I'd had a DWI many years before that, so I knew this is not wise to do this. It's pretty dangerous, but I just decided I can do this. I can make it home from Maplewood to Ham Lake to my mobile home. And so about the third time I pulled over to get air, to get my senses about me so that I wouldn't get in a fatal accident or get a DWI, about the third time I did that, happened to be in North Heights Lutheran Church parking lot. I was raised Catholic, but it was just religion to me. It didn't mean much personally. After I hit puberty, got through high school, I wasn't going to church anymore, and I was exploring Buddhism, transcendental meditation, you name it. I was looking at everything because I was always a searcher. I've always had that in my soul of wanting to know the truth. But I didn't, and I never really rejected Christ, but I just wasn't too sure, didn't really believe. Anyway, at this point, at 37 years old, almost 38, I'm standing there in a church parking lot, stone drunk, and my eye caught on the crucifix on top of the church just for a moment as I'm standing there, and I just said, "Christ, help me home." Wanting to get to my mobile home without a DWI or an accident, that's what I was asking for, because I knew that, I knew because of how I was raised and what I knew, what I learned, I knew that that cross represented something real, that it wasn't like Aesop's fables or Greek mythology. I realized in my soul that represents something real. And also, that I was being really dumb and foolish and was tricking myself because I thought, you know, I can run myself, my life pretty good by myself. I'm doing a pretty good job. I'm pretty self-sufficient. And then I realized, really? You're here, sick, drunk, ready to throw up, kill somebody else and yourself. Really? You're Mr. Self-Sufficient, got it all together? So that was kind of going through my soul as I saw the cross and said, Christ, help me home. And later on, weeks after that, I realized that was all the repentance that he required. Because the next day, I called some AA groups. I woke up realizing that was really dumb, foolish, dangerous last night. You got an alcohol issue, deal with it now. That was just, I knew I needed to do something. I was thinking like an adult. And so I made some phone calls. And a black man talked to me for an hour, invited me to his church. And I didn't go there that Sunday, but the following Sunday I did. It was the Holding Forth the Word of Life. And Holding Forth the Word of Life Church on Broadway and Penn in North Minneapolis, a black church, which I was comfortable with because I was the white guy in a black band for a while. And it was that was so fun. That's another story. Anyway, this woman preached. It was a three-hour service from 10 to 1, and this woman was preaching on brokenness. I remember that. And towards the end, she said, if anyone feels the need to call Christ into your heart, do so now. And I did. I felt the need. So then she said, well, those who put your hands up, please come forward. And it was me and the only other white person, I think a white woman on the other side. We came forward and confessed Christ as our Savior, said the sinner's prayer. And the woman said, welcome to the kingdom of heaven. I'd like you to talk with this man afterwards. And it was the guy who invited me there with his wife. I sat down with him and I said, I didn't know that was an altar call. You know, as Catholic, this is all very different. Instead of Tantum Ergo Sanctus Dei with the pipe organ, it was drums, bass, guitar, women singing like Aretha Franklin, clapping, waving. It was very different. I was really drawn into it. But I was just being led by Holy Spirit, not understanding in my spirit or even mind what was going on. But I was open enough that I just followed the Holy Spirit through the process. And so he said, don't worry, it's real, because he could tell that I doubted. I didn't know what happened, and I doubted anything happened at all, because I wasn't in tears, didn't see any blinding light like Paul, nothing like that. It was just a matter of fact. So I wasn't convinced anything real happened there. But because Holy Spirit was leading me, I was looking at Scripture, and I read Romans 10:9 that says, call on the name of the Lord, and you shall be saved. And when I read that Scripture, I remembered, when I was sick, drunk, ready to throw up in the parking lot, saw the cross, I said his name. I said, Christ, help me home. And I realized, that's all it took. He's that gracious. He's that merciful that all he required was for me to say his name, say Christ, recognizing who he is, what that cross represents, help me home. And just with just the little amount of repentance that I had at that moment, realizing, yeah, I'm not so self-sufficient. I'm a mess. And if I allow you to, you'll fix that. I just knew that in my soul, and that was all the repentance that he needed. And I was using alcohol, smoking pot for years after that. It was hard to get free, so that's why I minister in jail now. That's where I met the man probably who invited me here. And that's a wonderful, it started out as a ministry, like something I knew I should do, and it just became more and more of a joy as time goes on, because I'm following the path that Christ would have me do, and it's fun. That's what I like here when I see the kids worship here. They're having the time of their life. They're having fun. And so often you when you go to church, you know, people are singing and all that, but the kids are, man, you can't have a better time than that. And as a worshiper myself, that, you know, I spend a lot of my life, I went from an entertainer to a worshiper, so I focus on that quite a bit. But I just love seeing the young people here just, yes, have fun. Because he doesn't want you to be, oh, I worship you. You know, worship is like, yeah. It's, anyway, I'll shut up.
Thank you. Yeah, so my testimony is so different from any other testimony I've ever heard that it took me years and years before I realized that I actually could have a testimony, because I spent most of my life thinking that if I didn't do drugs or go to jail or all of that terrible stuff, then I couldn't have a testimony. I'm like, then I don't want to have a testimony. I want to do that. And so just probably in the last 5 years, 5 to 7 years, I've realized, oh, I can have a testimony. It's just your story. I'm like, oh, well, I have a story. That's easy. I don't remember when I got saved. I mean, I probably said the salvation prayer about 100 times because I just wanted to make sure because I couldn't remember. I cannot imagine not having God, not having Jesus in my life. Like, I have no idea what my life would be, and I'd rather not know either. But if someone came and tried to tell me, hey, God isn't real, like, there is no possible way they could prove that to me, because I know, and I, like, not that I had any big, huge moments, but I can look back at my life and see all the very subtle, tiny, intricate ways that he's been there, whether it was a car accident where we were rear-ended and our van was totaled and I was in the back seat and nothing happened other than a terrible headache for about 15 minutes, but, you know, whatever. Moving. We've moved twice. We moved from Nebraska to Minnesota and then from Moorhead to here, and we would never have done that if it wasn't for God. I wouldn't be here if he didn't exist. Like, I literally wouldn't be here if he didn't exist, because he wouldn't have married my mom, and I wouldn't literally exist. There's no reason. There's no way. I mean, he's provided. Like, I've seen him provide the money and the food and the groceries and the necessities that we needed when we didn't have any money coming in. I've seen him provide stuff for the studio for Dare to Dream when it was free and we were getting no money, and he's provided costumes, he's provided hundreds of other things. I mean, he's been there. Like, I think about the times where I just, like, have to lean on God and I just cry out to him and I'm like, how could anybody do this without him? I just don't understand. And again, I don't want to understand. I've experienced peace that I can't explain. I've been healed. Like, just earlier this year, I had terrible, it was like a fever, cold, flu, something, where, like, I was freezing, my body was aching so bad, it hurt, everything hurt, and, you know, Daddy prayed for me, and I was healed, like, instantly. Never have I experienced that, and I've seen and heard and experienced so many things that there's no possible way that he couldn't be real. And even what Brian was saying, where if there wasn't a God, there was no reason to live. There really isn't. And going to the Creation Museum last year, I think it was last year, and, like, they're comparing what the evolutionists say and what the creationists say, and I'm like, these people have no hope. There's no purpose, and I can't imagine not having a purpose. Like, so, I mean, I was asked recently, kind of like, what is your why? Why do you serve God? Why do you follow him? Why do you do what you do? And just, I'm like, I don't know how to explain it, but I'm starting to understand. I serve with kids. Kids have been my life since I was out of kids ministry. I was in kids ministry. And part of the, at least part of the reason is so that these kids can have the same testimony that I do, where they don't have the terrible things that happen to them. And they can't imagine not believing in Jesus, because, I mean, like, are you crazy? How could I not? Like, he's, I don't have any big stories. I don't have any big anything, except that I'm here in this city at this church completely in awe. I have said to my parents multiple times, I'm like, I don't know how we deserve this. I don't know how we got this. Why did God choose us to be here at this church and so blessed with the family and the people that we have, where, you know, he called us away from our family and our friends twice, and totally gave us exactly what we didn't have and what we needed and what I so wanted that I didn't realize that I wanted until I didn't have it, and or how much it, how important it was to me until it did, I didn't have it, which I guess is, a lot of people realize that. But, like, I wouldn't have a studio, a dance studio. I wouldn't be going to school to become an author to write books because I hated English. I still have no idea why I now want to write stories. But I can't say anything about my life without there being a hint of God. Then maybe it's, and it's not, like, I could tell you all kinds of stories that I wouldn't even mention God's name, but those stories wouldn't be happening if it wasn't for those subtle and intricate ways that he's been there in my life. He's intervened in these ways that I don't even know. And honestly, I cannot imagine not having him. And there's been times where I've been like, you know, I wonder, like, is this real what I believe? Like, everybody, other people in other religions, they believe that it's real. So how do I know that this one is true? And, you know, the thought lasts about 30 seconds. And I'm like, well, how can it not be true? And that's just kind of my whole, I don't know, like the just that I have no reason not to believe. So therefore I believe. And I have reason to believe. So therefore I believe. And yeah, like I would, that's why. That's, I think, part of that heart behind why I serve with the kids is so they can have the same testimony where they just don't know how to not believe. And then their families and their children can have the same story where they've just grown up with it and it's their life. Serving Jesus and serving others with his love is part of who they are and it can't be separated from them. Yeah.